Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Welcome to the latest Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm Distinguished Research Fellow at the OIES. It's my great pleasure to be joined today by Mahua Mohajee, who's Senior Research Fellow at the OIS, and we're here today to discuss the key messages that came from her paper, Building the Indian Carbon Market, a Work in Progress, that was published by the Institute on the 15th of May, 2023. Mahua, welcome back to the OIS podcast series.
Thank you, David, and it's very nice to be here.
Well, Mahua, you know, India, I expect, you know, like other signatories to the Paris Agreement, must be working hard to set up a carbon market at the moment, now that, of course, the Paris rulebook has been agreed. Now, can you perhaps tell us how that is going?
That's right, David. Exactly. India is working hard, as you say. That's exactly what's going on now. Let me tell you, one of the existing acts in the energy sector was amended by both Houses of Parliament at the end of last year. And that act gave the government various new powers in the energy sector. And one of these was indeed the ability to set up a carbon market. So although this updated act came into force on January 1st, 2023, the carbon market idea itself is not exactly new in India. As you may know, India used to be a very active participant in the old carbon credits market that was called the Clean Development Mechanism, or CDM, under the Kyoto Protocol. That market ended in 2020 when the Kyoto Protocol was not renewed. And I'd say the difference between then and now was that under CDM, only the developed countries were the carbon credit buyers. The carbon credit issuers who were hosting the carbon reduction projects were the developing countries. But today, all countries have taken on the responsibility for reducing emissions under the Paris Agreement. So both rich and poor have announced their nationally determined contributions, or NDC targets. There's no clear definition anymore between who the buyers and sellers are. And considering India's ambitious nationally determined contributions, or NDCs, the main thing I wanted to say at this stage is that India has announced at the outset that the carbon market it's currently setting up is going to be primarily for domestic players only. So the government has massively limited the possibility of international buyers for its domestically issued carbon credits. That means nearly all the carbon credits will be traded inside the country, and that is until India's ambitious NDCs are met. And then any additional credits that are surplus to India's requirements can be transferred abroad later for someone else to purchase and claim against their own decarbonisation goals.
Well, Mahua, that is indeed, you know, a very big change from the Kyoto Protocol days, when, of course, India was the second largest issuer of CERs, which were purchased by developed country buyers. So how is this mainly domestic market supposed to work out in India?
Well, the Indian Carbon Market, or ICM, as the domestic carbon market is to be known, is still a work in progress, as we were saying. The rules and regulations are being finalized, and we expect that the market will be launched later in 2023. What has become clear, though, not just in India, but this also happens to be the case in Indonesia, which likewise has banned exports of carbon credits, is that there is now a competing interest between using the carbon market to meet one's own NDCs by keeping the emission reduction certificates at home, versus trading them across borders and accepting international payments for them, or the so-called additional financing streams. So India, as a large country with its own ambitious goals, is saying until we reach our emission reduction target, we will not permit someone else to claim the benefit of an emission reduction project that is carried out in India and funded and built with Indian resources. But I should mention quickly that it's not completely watertight, though. That's why the government says there won't be trading unless there are exceptional circumstances. And we do happen to already know what some of those exceptional circumstances are, meaning they have said something about the circumstances under which they will allow exports of carbon credits. And I can tell you about those exceptions in a bit. But getting back to your question on how it's all going to work, by and large, here's what the domestic ICM, the Indian carbon market, is going to look like in its early years. First of all, the government is relying on Indian finances, which could be government or private sector finances, to invest in public and private emission reduction projects, because it's these projects which create the supply of carbon credits. You also need sufficient demand for the market to work. So on the demand side, the government is relying on creating a set of conditions, which we can go into later, that will hopefully have Indian buyers queuing up to pay for these credits generated from the domestic projects. And so they want to ensure that the demand will come from buyers who'll see the carbon credit certificate as a must-have item and thereby bid up its price. And there are a few things the government is planning to stimulate that kind of demand. So actually, essentially, it's really going to depend on both supply and demand for the carbon credit certificates. And that will determine the market price, which will in turn show whether this is going to be a success or not.
Okay, I get that. So how is all this, do you think, going to be managed? Who's going to run the show, from which ministry, and, you know, what is the plan?
Well, there's a very capable agency under the Central Power Ministry, which is called the Bureau of Energy Efficiency, or BEE. They are going to be the administrators of the new Indian carbon market. And, of course, there'll be close collaboration of the Ministry of Power with the Ministry of the Environment as well. And that's because all the state pollution control boards and the state forestry departments have a dotted reporting line to the Environment Ministry. And those agencies have the primary responsibility to enforce the existing laws against pollution and tree cutting, for example. And this is important because you have to ensure that the gains you achieve from your new mitigation projects are not slipping away from your other pocket in the form of rampant pollution and deforestation. So you have to sort of protect the gains, and that means you have to enforce your existing laws. So the two ministries, Power Ministry and Environment Ministry, are jointly responsible for looking out for the whole emission reduction pie. So the existing laws under the authority of these agencies, as I was saying, have to be enforced rigorously in the first place in order to tackle the emissions problem from both sides. So first control what you're already supposed to be controlling to ensure that you don't have a leaky bucket and you're not going to be reversing the good impacts that the carbon market is trying to create. Then go the extra mile and incentivize some new emission reduction actions that would not have happened without the extra incentives by also launching a carbon market. So that's why these two ministries are leading the show together here. But having said that, it's the Bureau of Energy Efficiency as the administrator which has the hands-on responsibility to get the actual carbon market off the ground. And let me just mention that they are well qualified for this because they already have over 20 years of experience running a very large industrial-sized compliance market that is an energy efficiency program, and it issues energy savings certificates. So that existing program will be modified and will be rolled into the new carbon market as one of its pillars. And the second pillar of the carbon market will come from another compliance market that's also up and running today in India, and that will be likewise modified and rolled into the new carbon market. And that one is the renewable energy certificate market that helps the so-called obligated companies to meet their renewable purchase obligations. So with RECs, the renewable energy certificates, there's again a need to change the units. So today they're being issued in megawatt hours, just as the energy savings certificates are being issued in tons of oil equivalent. And all of these will be renamed carbon credit certificates after a two-year transition period. And they'll all be denominated in tons of avoided CO2. And that makes sure that they're both using the same currency. And that immediately vastly expands the market. It ends the fragmentation of having a separate energy efficiency market, a separate renewable energy certificate market. And it also becomes more competitive when they expand the pool of eligible buyers. This is based on some lessons learned. And BEE has been doing this very well. So it's hoped that they will, take this change into their stride. And the third and last pillar of the forthcoming Indian carbon market is the voluntary market. This market comprises entities that are under no legal or regulatory obligation to build any renewable energy projects, nor to undertake any responsible waste management initiatives or perform any other emission reduction activity, but they still want to participate, and they'll hopefully be well incentivized to do so quite early on. So this voluntary market, unlike the compliance market we were talking about earlier with the energy efficiency and the renewable energy certificates, this voluntary market is very responsive to price signals. And by the way, the voluntary market applies to both private and public sector companies who can take part in it, and they will use their resources to create emission reduction projects that they will have to then try to enter into the carbon registry.
So the voluntary market is also going to be part of the new Indian carbon market. Mahul, could you tell us first about the concept of additionality, which I presume would also apply in the Indian voluntary carbon market?
Yes, David, I'm so glad you raised that point about additionality. It will definitely apply, and it's actually really important to understand it in order to get a better idea about this third pillar of the market and who's actually playing there. I'll get to additionality in just a second, which is what you asked about. But first, there's the concept of the baseline. In other words, what would emissions have been without the project for which you want to claim credits? We need to understand that in order to understand additionality. So let me just say that essentially, you need the baseline scenario in order to put forward the difference in emissions in the with project and without project case. So the baseline is usually the higher emissions scenario that would apply in the business as usual or without project case. Then you say, relative to this baseline, the emissions of my activity will be, say, 65% lower because of my mitigation project. So instead of X tons of CO2 emissions today, I will only have 0.35X tons of emissions or whatever. So all this must be part of your application for getting your project registered and approved. And your claims will be verified once your project is built, and the carbon credit certificates will only be given then. So here's a key point about the voluntary or offset market. The difference in emissions between the baseline and your project's emissions is what you will receive carbon credit certificates for. So getting your baseline right is extremely important. You can't put down whatever you like in the application. You need to follow accepted methodologies for the baseline, and those are part some of the rules that are currently being finalized. Now we come to your question. The other important concept apart from baseline is of additionality, as you mentioned, and that goes as follows. If you want to get into the carbon registry, you must also show that your emission reduction project would not be financially feasible without the money from selling the carbon credits. The last thing people want is to give out precious carbon credits to projects that were, let's say, going to happen anyway, meaning that they are not additional. The carbon credit market is supposed to stimulate additional projects that are totally financially dependent on the money from selling the certificates and would otherwise remain on the drawing board without that revenue stream. So one certificate that you can earn represents one ton of avoided CO2 emissions.
Thank you, Mihir. So could you perhaps give us an illustration of who the presumed market participants might be in the voluntary market and what a project could look like, especially on the supply side? I mean, you know, why would a company come forward to spend their precious money on emissions reduction projects when there's no actual regulation compelling them to act? And what makes them want to participate in this new carbon credit market and meet the difficult hurdles of additionality and then emerge as an issuer of carbon credits?
That's a great question. So here's an illustrative example of the concept of additionality in the voluntary market, which takes on your question of why someone would do something that they were not legally required to do. Let's suppose a company owns office buildings, say in 15 of India's 28 states. They've been around for a long time. They purchased the air conditioning units in their offices around a decade ago. The air conditioners are all still working well, but they happen to use an outdated, harmful refrigerant that is banned today for new AC units. So this company has been thinking for some time that it would really like to green their network of office buildings throughout the country by replacing 1,000 air conditioners that have the old refrigerant R22 in them, say, which has a very high global warming potential. In fact, I read somewhere that a pound of R22 can do the same climate damage as 1 ton of CO2. But you might ask, why haven't they done anything about it so far? And why do they keep going with their existing old equipment? And the answer is because so far, the expense of tearing out the old ACs and replacing them with new environmentally responsible ones was not proving to be affordable in light of the company's many other expenditure priorities. Now, enter the carbon credit certificate, which is worth actual money in the secondary market once the project benefits are verified by a third party, of course. So a project which was not previously financially feasible in the absence of a carbon market suddenly becomes financially feasible with the extra cash inflow from selling the carbon credits to a buyer. And this is called meeting the test of financial additionality. Remember, in this case, both the seller and the buyer can only be domestic entities, meaning Indian companies or individuals, because the ban on exporting carbon credit certificates until India's 2030 NDC goals are met. So this forthcoming carbon market in India is basically mobilizing domestic climate finance and trying to meet its NDCs.
Okay, you know, I can see, Mahua, that it's important to keep the demand for these certificates high so that, you know, they trade at a decent price and ensure a meaningful cash flow stream from their sale. But could you say a bit on what the government plans to do to ensure there's enough demand from buyers to keep this market going?
Yes, a key question is indeed, as you point out, how does the demand for carbon credit certificates get to be high and stay that way? That is again up to the government to some extent, to nudge the entire domestic economy into a desire to purchase these certificates. For example, the government could do so by saying that it will gradually introduce a sustainable public procurement scheme, meaning that the government will procure products and services on its vast shopping list, which consists of everything from guns to butter, as the saying goes, and it will do so preferentially from carbon neutral suppliers, organizations, and service providers, starting in just a few short years from now. So anybody who wants to supply the government has to get ready, and therefore interested suppliers who survive on government contracts need to start getting ready immediately, and they will compete with each other to get their hands on whatever verified certificates will be coming onto the market. And in the meantime, there's also some discussion of a so-called EcoMark label to be introduced for companies that will earn points on a scale when they're verified to be voluntarily decarbonizing over time, such as the hypothetical AC replacement example we mentioned earlier. If that were a supplier company, they would certainly get points for doing that replacement of their ACs. So a part of this EcoMark score can be tangibly demonstrated through the purchase and ownership of carbon credit certificates. So that is the plan at the moment to keep up the interest in the demand side for carbon credit certificates.
Now, Mahua, you know, it seems to me that just really the projects going to be built mainly are for domestic buyers who wish to reduce their carbon footprint for, you know, for whatever reason. And as you've said, a lot of emission reduction projects that have been on the back of people's minds may now come out and actually see the light of day if they can be partly funded with carbon credits, which was not, of course, the case. So is this really just another form of climate finance? And in India's case, you know, will it all be domestically financed?
Yes, exactly. As you know, there has not been any international climate finance available to India. So whatever has been invested for, I think they have about 160 gigawatts of clean energy installed generation capacity, that's all come from domestic sources, both public sector and private sector. But getting back to your interesting point about carbon credits being a form of climate finance, I do totally agree with you. And the administrator is working hard to put all the elements in place before launching the market. But that can only happen after the emission reductions are confirmed by suitably accredited parties. And the first cohort of those accredited parties actually need to get their accreditations before the market can be launched. And then there's also a need for an approved monitoring, reporting, and verification, or MRV method. So all that is sort of currently going on at the moment behind the curtains. And then qualified project applications, once the market is launched, those qualified project applications will go on to BEE's registry as carbon offset projects, and there'll be a record of the credits issued to the company that undertook the emission reduction action. And this is really important to avoid double counting.
Okay, I see that. And it fortunately sounds like the Bureau of Energy Efficiency, or BEE, is experienced in managing such a carbon registry, as you said earlier on. But could you tell our listeners a bit more about the program that BEE has been running for two decades? And I'm referring to the one that will involve the first pillar of the new Indian carbon market.
Yes, indeed. So the first pillar will come from a compliance market-based emissions trading scheme that the BEE, Bureau of Energy Efficiency, runs right now. That program is designed to push large energy-intensive firms to continuously increase their energy efficiency. And it's called the PAT scheme, P-A-T, which stands for Perform, Achieve, Trade. The PAT scheme currently issues so-called energy savings certificates, or ES certs, to a designated group of large industries that have no choice but to participate in the energy efficiency program run by BEE for regulatory reasons. So the regulation puts these designated companies on an energy diet, as it were, forcing them to figure out how to reduce their energy use per unit of production, year after year. And less energy use, of course, results in fewer emissions, although that was not the metric until now. The so-called designated consumers, by the way, that are subject to this forced participation in the compliance market, come from over a dozen different energy-intensive industrial sectors, including aluminium, iron and steel, fertilizer, pulp and paper, thermal power generation, railways, cement, chlor-alkali, textiles, etc. Their energy savings targets are set by benchmarking against their most efficient peers in their sector. So here's how the incentive works today in that BEE program. If a designated consumer manages to overachieve their targeted energy savings, they earn energy savings certificates for the extra energy reduction they attain over and above their target. If, on the other hand, a designated consumer does not manage to even achieve their targeted energy savings for a given year, let alone overachieve, then they can either pay a penalty to BEE, or they can choose to buy their energy savings certificates from the overachievers group who are holding these certificates. So either way, the non-achievers have a monetary outlay because they underachieved and didn't make their target. The BEE certificates, as mentioned, are denominated today in tons of oil equivalent. Basically, in 2 years' time, the fragmentation that we currently have of having some ES certificates and some renewable energy certificates that are denominated in two different units, the oil equivalent and the megawatt hours, will be gone. And in their place will be a uniform set of just carbon credit certificates, or CCCs. In fact, these CCCs will start being issued later this year, but during the transition period, the other two will also still be active alongside to give all the designated consumers time to adjust.
Now, I understand that in some limited exceptional circumstances, the government might permit international trading of CCCs issued in India. So as we end this podcast, can I kind of ask you a two-part question? Could you first address what exactly it was that motivated the government to go for a purely domestic carbon market, apart from the reason they want to meet their NDCs first? You know, was there anything else behind this unusual decision to ban international trading of Indian carbon credits? And the second part of my question is, you know, I'm curious to know, what are the activities that the government has identified as possible exceptions to its no international trading of carbon credits rule?
Let me first give you a quick answer to your important question about why they've decided to minimize the circumstances under which they'll allow mitigation projects in India to fulfill another country's decarbonization requirements, because that's essentially what the trading brings about. And then I'll tell you about the few exceptions that the government is willing to make to the domestic-only preference for the ICM. So in terms of why there's a trade ban, actually, there's a passage which appears quite explicitly in the BEE's policy paper. So what I'm about to say is not speculation on my part. It can be verified. If you remember, the Clean Development Mechanism, or CDM, of the 1990s and 2000s, there were large numbers of projects originating emissions reductions in India. Carbon prices were decently high at $20 per CER, which each represented 1 ton of CO2 avoided. Then, without warning, there was a unilateral decision taken by the European Union in 2012. No consultations were held whatsoever, which greatly offended the affected countries, including India. Overnight, the European Union decided that it would only purchase CERs from the least developed countries during the period 2013 to 2020. Which was the remaining life of the Kyoto Protocol. This crashed the price of Indian CERs immediately from $20 to half a dollar, $0.5. Indian project developers with completed projects were left holding worthless paper, and those who were halfway through the construction of a project were financially hurt. So this CDM fiasco in 2012 created a huge trust deficit concerning the carbon market. The BEE's draft policy paper notes that this time the Indian government would like to maintain control, keep things predictable, and above all, protect Indian investor interests, meaning it wants to protect those who invest in emission reduction projects. The reason for the trading ban is precisely to avoid the 2012 experience by getting involved with fickle foreign buyers, essentially nothing more and nothing less. Now we come to the second question, where you asked what the exceptions were under which the Indian government was prepared to actually relax this stance. In other words, what circumstances would persuade the government to allow emission reductions generated in India to be claimed by an international buyer? So according to the BEE policy paper, the Indian issuer market is proven to be good at design, execution, and cost competitiveness of what are known as mature renewable energy technologies, such as solar, onshore wind, biogas, etc. These are routine, reliably replicable, uncomplicated, and low cost. These are the ones that will contribute steadily to India's NDC targets, and these are the ones that will not be permitted to engage in cross-border trading of the ensuing emission reductions. These are already sort of well under control. However, the government understands that it is still behind the curve in terms of experience with cutting-edge mitigation technologies. Therefore, the government has identified a series of exceptions in terms of new technologies, which should also come with associated financing, by the way, to invest in projects in India. So what this boils down to is, if a third party is bringing a technology from the specific list given by the government, and the third party also provides the funds, which are essentially climate finance, needed to undertake the investment in that new technology, then they are welcome to claim the emission reductions resulting from that project. This is the Indian government's own additionality criterion, if you like. So accordingly, the government has drawn up a list of clean energy technologies that are operating elsewhere, but not yet commonplace in India. These include mitigation projects like offshore wind, green hydrogen, green ammonia, carbon capture usage and storage, a whole range of tidal and ocean energy technologies, manufacturing of electrolyzers, fuel cells for e-mobility, long-duration energy storage technologies, sustainable aviation fuel, enhanced transmission line technologies, and so on. So these are in the list of exceptions mentioned by the government so far. And the rule is that if an investor is prepared to invest in any of these, and as I mentioned, brings along the associated capital and expertise, then in addition to that investor being allowed to keep the financial returns that are earned on the project, he or she will also be able to repatriate the associated measured and verified emission reductions by means of a carbon credit certificate. David, I hope that answered your two-part final question.
It did, it did. I particularly like the fickle foreign buyer. I thought that was an excellent explanation. So Mihir, thank you so much for your time today. And I really enjoyed, as always, our conversation that builds on the messages from your paper, Building the Indian Carbon Market, a Work in Progress, that was recently published by the OIES. So I hope you've all enjoyed listening to this podcast. Thank you and goodbye, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our energy transition, gas, oil, electricity, or China research programs, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.